everyone. I am thrilled to introduce you to my guest today. She is an author, artist, and most recently, a stand-up comic. Welcome, Jessie Kenelos-Wiener. Jessie was raised in Chicago and made her way to Paris after college as an au pair. And on her last night before heading back to the States, she met a French photographer at the now defunct bar Le Poppin. After a short time in New York City, she and said Frenchman decided to shack up together and settle down in Paris. And as a way to process her observations and complex feelings about her new life abroad, she started a phenomenal blog called The Francofly in 2011. That's how I first discovered her work. Since that fateful moment when she decided to stop taking photographs and instead illustrate her stories with her own bright, whimsical, and often comical watercolors, she's literally taken the art world by storm. She's published an illustrated cookbook, a coloring book, a calendar, as well as two best-selling travel guides, Paris in Stride and New York in Stride. Her work has been featured in some of the most famous publications around the world, from Vogue and the New York Times to the Wall Street Journal and Elle, just to name a few. And she's currently working on a new book that's called Watercolor, A Visual Journey into Creativity, Observation, and Storytelling, which draws on her own unique experience of healing through art. Jessie also teaches art at the Paris College of Art and does live illustrations at private events. She's one of the most adventurous, intuitive artists I know, which is why I asked her to make the cover art for this very podcast you're listening to. I really hope you enjoy discovering her journey, how she's navigated periods of grief, and how watercolor has been there to help her through it, and what's really going on underneath the surface behind this desire to tell funny stories to strangers in a dark, dingy basement of a club. Grab yourself a cup of coffee, settle in, enjoy this podcast, and please let me know what comes up for you as you listen to Jessie's fascinating journey. Hi, Jessie.
Hi, Ziva. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited to have you on the show today. We've discussed this a little bit in private, but as you know, this podcast takes a look under the hood, so to speak, to kind of unpack and examine the different stepping stones along the becoming journey of women that I find particularly inspiring. So thank you so much for joining me in this adventure.
Of course, it's my pleasure.
Just curious, anything before we begin you are particularly interested in digging into in your own path that maybe you'd want to explore a little bit more, unpack with me and with the listeners?
Is this a free session with Ziva? I think I've kind of been this introspective moment in my life. So maybe I feel like there have been a few moments in my life where I really had to manifest something happening, either that's moving to France or et cetera. So we could talk about that, or we could talk about healing one's inner child or attempting to, or trying to, find the thread that weaves through one's life, so to speak.
Okay. Well, that's an ambitious agenda. Let's get to it. Okay. So as I've been preparing for this interview, I've been having a lot of fun going back in time and exploring your blog, The Francofly, which I was super excited to realize is still in existence after, 12 years?
Has it been 12 years? Yeah, I haven't. I guess my domain is automatically renewed every year. So even if I've been a little negligent, it's still around.
Yeah, I checked. I think your first publication was in March 2011.
Wow. Okay.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit about your background and how you went from living in Chicago, growing up in Chicago, to starting a kind of a lifestyle blog in Paris in 2011.
So I was born and raised in Chicago in the city. So you and I are both city kids. So not Fort Wayne, Indiana, but Chicago. Okay.
Okay. Ooh, I heard the accent.
Yeah. Chicago. It comes up every now and then. And so, I grew up, my parents bought a house on the north side of Chicago when it was rough, maybe they're the original gentrifiers, even though they'll probably be shocked to hear that, but they bought a house, in the 80s, in this really kind of mixed. Chicago's great because it's a city of different pockets of people. So the north side, you know, there are lots of German immigrants and Greek immigrants, et cetera. So they bought this giant greenhouse on the corner, and that's where I spent my days. So my parents are youth pastors. They work for an organization, and that's how they met. That's how they connected. So I think what's rare about my parents in particular is that they are all about working together with some kind of a mission in their life. So I think that regardless if I liked it or not, I think the whole family was kind of along for the ride, so to speak. So their work was a little bit different. I think, you know, deep down, they're probably both hippies in one way or another. So they didn't have typical, you know, 9 to 5 jobs. And so because of that, I had a lot of free time, I think, on my own. I don't know where they were exactly, but I've learned through time that a lot of artists, you know, I think you kind of have to, when you have a lot of time on your own and you're bored, you have to find a way to create some kind of fantasy world to live in. So I think that's really how it started. So I'm just going to keep talking. So feel free if I'm
Yeah,
getting on
no, this
tangents.
is interesting. I love this. Keep going.
So my mom was an art teacher. She studied art in college, and so it's never, you know, too far from, you know, it's not by coincidence that I do what I do. And my dad is, you know, a total baby boomer. I had 5 brothers and sisters, and his father was a Greek immigrant, and so it was always kind of the plan that my dad would follow in my grandfather's footsteps and become a lawyer. But my dad, you know, it's kind of that generation where they're like, I don't have to do what the status quo says, man. And so he ended up going to law school, dropping out, and then doing various other things, working in insurance. And then when he met my mom was volunteering for this organization that they work for now. And they both decided eventually that they wanted, that's just what their mission in life was, to help inner city kids and to create programs and different opportunities just to reach out to other people. So they've been doing this kind of work for almost 40 years. So
Oh, wow.
yeah, it's cool. And I got to give it to them because, you know, we're in the inner city. I mean, these weren't this wasn't, you know, a suburban ambiance by any means, but I think even way back when, they've really kind of been groundbreaking in how they've created, you know, programs and reached out to what's the word I'm looking for? Diversity and creating, you know, communities where people are included and doing that kind of work. So more power to them.
So your parents were mission driven since you were a little girl. That's the way you remember, because you
Yeah,
grew
for
up in that
yes.
environment. And
Yes,
so, and
yes.
you had a lot of, so you had a lot of time on your own because they were taken with their own vision and their own, like their own calling. So it sounds like you had a lot of time to yourself to explore your inner world and develop that.
Exactly. So, I mean, I wasn't a latchkey kid by any means, but I feel like I had that time where I was just able to look out the window and be bored out of my mind and just trying to think of scenarios and inner dialogues and all of this kind of stuff just to pass the time.
But were you illustrating and writing back then? Was that something that you developed when you were a little girl?
Yeah, I forgot about it, but my mom saved everything that I did as a kid. And so they sold our house in Chicago. So when she was going through all the boxes, she found a lot of the books that I wrote. And so I even have a cookbook called Jessie's Wonderful Book of Recipes. And it, you know, it was it's very funny because it's very representative of, you know, growing up in Chicago. So there was a caramel apple Euros and all of these, and a live pigeon with honey Dijon mustard. And so it was funny that
Wow.
I was, you know, taking all these pieces, collecting things in my world, and then recreating them in other ways.
Wow.
So, yeah, even my mom has records of, you know, when I was a kid and I was always gluing things together and ripping things apart, and always been into glitter and things like that. So it's, yeah, it's funny. I think there was definitely something there from the beginning, and it was more about growing up and trying to find something to do with all of that.
How did you eventually wind up in Paris?
So I think the first moment that I kind of had to manifest my destiny, so to speak, was I was a senior in high school, and my parents said, Jess, you know, we don't have any money for college, so you're going to have to figure this out on your own. So luckily, I was able to get a full scholarship to a great liberal arts school called Denison University. where I studied theater and studio art. And then I graduated. I had a year before I had to pay off my student loan. So I thought, this is time to travel. This is time to indulge this part of me before I have to take my life seriously. And so I found an au pair job. And I moved to Paris maybe a month or so after I graduated from college. So I had no preconceived notions of what Paris would be. I thought, you know, I love culture, I love art, I love all these things. So why not just give it a shot? And if I can learn a language, then more power to me. And that's initially how I moved to Paris. And so I was an au pair, which wasn't amazing.
Were you an au pair in Paris?
In Paris in the 12th, and with a nouveau riche family that treated me poorly. I was expecting, you know, to eat pig's feet and, you know, head cheese and things like this. And they ate Harry's sliced bread every day and Nutella. And they're the kind of people who watch TV from, you know, as soon as they got home until the morning hours. So it wasn't necessarily the cultural renaissance that I was hoping for. But yeah, I went out as much as I could. I tried to meet people, but it wasn't what I thought Paris would be, unfortunately. And the conditions weren't always stellar, so to speak. Because I think to be a good au pair, you have to have your own spot, your own studio apartment somewhere. But I was living with the family within the confines of the home, so it was weird.
That's so fun. I don't know if we've ever shared this story. I didn't know this about your story, but I also had one of those moments when I was living in Paris as a student, and I had, of course, this very romantic vision of what my life would be like, where the host family would have a house in the countryside, and we'd go, you know, we'd take these wonderful weekends away, and there'd be this, like, you know, boisterous, fun-loving family. We do all sorts of activities together. And it turns out that they put me in a home with a single mom.
Okay.
Who had two jobs, and she was very, you know, she was very busy, and I wound up by myself all the time.
Yeah.
And she didn't know how to cook, and she...
Oh, no.
Yeah. And they served me cheval, horse meat. Oh, wow. One time, and I was a vegetarian. So I really...
Welcome to Paris. Welcome in Paris. So...
yeah. So for me, I was like, well, I'm gonna come back and do it my way. That was clearly not the ideal way to do it, but it didn't discourage me from, still wanting to live out my own fantasy. And so what was it like for you having a different version of the life you had expected you'd have here?
Well, I think the context, I just graduated from this, you know, kind of bougie liberal arts school, or, you know, you could find, you know, pizza party at any spot on campus whenever you wanted. And then, you know, I was able to kind of, you know, do whatever I wanted there, and was super close with my professors, and they were super invested in anything I wanted to do. And then I came here and I knew no one. And I was at the beck and call of this horrible 4-year-old who was verbally abusive. I didn't speak the language. I thought I spoke French, but I didn't. I mean, I have a few people I know since then, and they said, you know, they would ask me a yes and no question, and my response would be, okay. And so, I mean, I think at that point, you know, when you're early 20s already, it's kind of a loaded time. It was just the financial crisis and everything. And I've always known I didn't have a traditional path to becoming whatever I was supposed to be, but it was really lonely. I felt really isolated, and I didn't know what this path was or why I was at this place. And, you know, I think you need a couple of years, or almost a few lost years, where you're just trying to, you know, work up some kind of semblance of job, things that are applicable to real jobs, or just kind of understanding yourself to be able to work in an environment, a normal work environment. But yeah, the first years were definitely very difficult. I felt like I was a 22-year-old loser who had no direction in life. And
so then what happened next?
So I was able to put up with this job for about a year, and I was ready to go back to the States. I accepted a master's in costume design in Boston. And then I went out on a Friday night and I met my now husband. So it definitely was unexpected. So at this point, I mean, I hated Paris. I had no reason to like it. I thought that, you know, if it was what I was living with, it wasn't for me. And so I ended up staying the summer and we were together. And then I ended up moving to Boston because I thought, well, this is what I'm supposed to do. I got this full ride to study what I want to study. But unfortunately, it wasn't that. So there are a few years where I was moving back and forth, didn't have a visa. I didn't really imagine what I could do in Paris because I just felt like it was so foreign. Obviously, when you don't have papers, you can't really do much. But it was really frustrating because I thought, well, love is this thing that's pulling me, but is this enough to move to a place and to invest everything? And I just kept trying and trying, and at the end of the day, it just never was enough, I found out the time.
That's so funny. I didn't know this. I felt like your Paris compass was set, and that was always the kind of trajectory you were meant to be on, or that you had decided you would be on despite the
No.
difficulties.
Yeah, not at all. And so I had a few flops, like a few 10-year stints in Paris where nothing was happening. I tried applying to schools and I couldn't make that work. And there was a moment where I was just like, this isn't working for me. I can't keep trying. I'm losing time. I'm 23 years old. I should know what I want to do with my life. And then I actually moved to New York. I thought, well, grad school's not going to work for me because it's a 3-year program. It's expensive. And I feel like I'm just going to have to move to New York anyway and just start from zero. So I ended up moving to New York with, I think, maybe $200 in my pocket in 2010. And I was still with, my now husband. And I said, like, I'm committed to being with you, but Paris for me is, I can't see any kind of future here. I've tried everything and I literally cannot find something that I want to do, So, I mean, I did everything I could. I taught English. I was a babysitter for many, many years, but there's a moment where you have to find something for yourself before you can move to another country. And so I moved to New York. I worked in costume design there for stage and film, and pretty quickly I was able to find interesting work, even if it wasn't paid. But I did that whole thing, and then there was a moment where my husband and I decided, I said, if you want to be with me, like, you're gonna have to marry me so that I can try to make Paris work the right way, So I feel like I needed that year too to kind of figure myself out and know that I could be on my own, and that I needed to spend that time to really find myself, part one, or I don't know. I think I proved to myself that I am independent, that I can be on my own.
Wow. Okay. So then you decided to marry, and that was when you were able to move to Paris and have that kind of foundation under you to.
That's when I started the blog, was right before I moved back to Paris indefinitely. And that was the next moment that I had to manifest. So I said, if I'm going to move back to Paris, I'm going to commit everything. There's no looking back. I'm not the kind of expat who's going to go home for 6 months out of the year. Like, this is going to be my life. I'm going to find something that I love and I'm going to make it work, 200%. So, the blog is kind of the companion piece to all that to say, you know what, this is what I'm doing. I have stories. I haven't really shared them in a while, but this is something that this is a time where, maybe having a blog could mean something or lead to something else. And so that's kind of where I was processing all the information about, getting married, moving to France, and I already had, 3, 4 years of stories that were accumulating at this point too. So it was exciting sharing that.
That's so interesting. So the blog for you was a place to park your stories and to kind of process the different experiences you were having. Was it, you were just talking about like manifesting. Was there a part of you that felt like you were putting yourself out there or creating a vitrine for yourself that would help other people find you or help identify what made your voice and your take on your experience valuable?
Yeah, I mean, I think there definitely is validation when other people read your work. And it's funny because even if it was just words at the beginning, I'm actually an illustrator because of the blog. So at the beginning, I put some really bad, this is before iPhone cameras, and so I put some really bad photos up there at the beginning. And then my now husband said, oh, you draw really well. You should put illustrations instead. And I was like, oh, I have never even thought about being an illustrator. That's crazy, crazy talk. And so the blog was a driver where I said, I have the idea. Here's a visual. I'm going to stick them together And that's really where something happened for me. And I was able not just to draw something, but I was able to tell a story through a visual. And that's really the catalyst that inspired my first wave of work. And was really, I mean, who would have thunk it, you know? Mm-hmm. Never would have expected that before.
So for you, the process is having the idea of the story or the reflection on an observation or experience that you have, and then you look for a way to illustrate it, or do you have the image that comes to mind and then the story kind of emerges out of it?
I mean, at the time, I would say it was probably more story driven, and then the image would come after that. But sometimes it's reverse. It really depends. But, you know, as a professional illustrator, clients come to me too, and they say, oh, we have this story about this subject. We need a visual. So I like being an illustrator too, because it really is about problem solving and saying, okay, here are the variables. Now it's up to me to find some kind of creative solution. So it was perfect training for becoming a professional illustrator.
So I remember when I reached out to you, I was racking my brain trying to remember when that date was, but it was before I became a coach. It was between mm-hmm. 2016 and 2018, I guess.
Oh, yes.
And I loved your work. I was a huge like fangirl on the side. And we met together because I had this idea for, I forget what it was, a blog or a podcast. I don't know. It was some, or I forget exactly, but it was circles. There were circles involved. And we met up for coffee and we discussed this project, which hadn't yet been confirmed. But I remember at the time you told me that you weren't yet working as a full-time artist, that you were still doing costume design and you had other gigs.
Yeah, I wasn't doing costume design. I was working as a food stylist too at the time.
As a food stylist.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
So that was your main gig at the time while you were doing illustrations for the blog?
Yes. I don't want to give anyone the impression that I became an illustrator overnight, because like everything, it took many years to A, get better, and B, to work on my network and everything. So when I moved to France indefinitely, as I like to say, I started the blog, and then I also started staging at a food photography studio of a friend of my husband's. And so I've always been a big foodie and I've loved cooking. And so thanks to that, I was able to start working as a food stylist and then, you know, doing illustrations on the side. And then it was kind of 50-50, and then it went back and forth a little bit. And then eventually I decided to phase out food styling because I was able to get enough work as an illustrator and committed to that 100%. So there were probably, yeah, maybe five years where I was doing both at the same time.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so the shift, what was that shift like? Was it, did you consider the art always to be the main goal and you were waiting to get enough clients in order to make that transition?
At the time, I was just happy to work in any kind of context. This is, you know, a couple of years into having working papers. So I was just excited to do something not babysitting related. And then, I mean, food styling is wonderful, and I feel like it's made me a better illustrator in a lot of ways, but it was physically quite exhausting because, you know, sometimes you're making 20 recipes for bœuf bourguignon a day. And so it's a lot of micromanaging and a lot of, schlepping of things. And, I just felt like I, at the end of the day, illustration gave me that, it just is much more nourishing creatively because I can sit down, I can concentrate. It's all me. I'm not relying on a collaboration with anyone else. And so in my mind, I felt like I wanted to phase it out eventually. And I just wanted to know if that would be possible financially, because obviously when you double your possibilities of work, it's makes more sense. So little by little, I was able to phase out styling. But, it, you know, there are a couple of years that have been a little bit less, there was less meat on the bone, so to speak. But, at the end of the day, I feel like I'm happy that I was able to do that because it's much more rewarding for me. And the thing, when you're a stylist too, you do a lot of, I mean, I'm not saying you don't do all the work, but you know, you're never credited either on your photos too. It's always a photographer who's credited. And so there's kind of a power dynamic too that I didn't really like so much.
How do you feel the food styling has influenced your work as a watercolorist? How has it helped you become a better artist?
I think that, you know, you have to be super meticulous about how you structure your time and all the tasks you need to perform. And then also, I think just, you know, you're building a composition. And so you have to think about all of these things, about things being appetizing, understanding color, and all the variables that go into creating something that you, in your mind, you want to create. And so in a way, it's easier to do it with watercolor, because you don't have to worry about, you know, getting this beautiful Japanese plate from the other side of the city and, you know, making sure that your burger is well cooked on the outside. And, you know, it's just much easier to control for me, I think. And I had more liberty to do things that out of the ordinary. I think in food styling, you're limited to what you can make out of actual food, even though that's not always 100% the case. But with food style, with illustration, I feel like I have much more creative liberty, and I can do so much more with so much little. So it just makes more sense. And I have much more of a voice too. I think I never really found my voice as a food stylist too. Even though I was able to do the job, I think automatically I had much something better to offer just as an illustrator alone.
That's so cool. Yeah. So you were able to kind of invent dishes, in that language, where you were able to create something from scratch that wasn't defined by the parameters of, is it perishable? How are you going to cook it? Where are you going to find it?
And then how are you going to style it? How are, you know, there's maybe a 10-minute window where things look appetizing. And so
and then it starts to go downhill.
Yes, exactly. So there for a couple of years at the end, it was difficult because I expanded. I was doing some prop styling for fashion brands as well. And so I just think that, photo has changed a lot in the past, you know, the last 10 years or so. And I just think the stress really started to eat at me too. So I needed to find a way to phase that out a little bit.
Fascinating. I really didn't know. I didn't know this part at all. And I can see definitely how that period of time of being in the trenches and, you know, working to develop your eye and working with things that you couldn't really control would maybe then allow you to really, really express your freedom and your artistic creativity, because you don't have the same kind of parameters.
But
you
exactly.
It's almost like you needed to, trudge through that in order to develop those nuances in your eye and in your the composition and the color and the texture.
Yes, definitely. You know, I think, you know, if for all the artists out there, it's just, I mean, I don't want to sound delusional, but I feel like I can do anything. You know, it's just a matter of learning the techniques. And it's just, I think there's a lot of overlap between, you know, music and art and all these different things. It's just a matter of, you know, if you want to pursue them professionally or not, or how do you develop certain skills that can be applied to other mediums as well.
Okay, cool. Well, I wanted to also talk about, so here you are, you're starting to get work as an artist. Things are hitting your stride, really, as an independent, coveted watercolorist. And you wind up first publishing your book, an illustrated travel book that you co-authored, called Paris in Stride. And you and I meet a little bit afterwards again. And this time you reach out because you're working on a second book called New York in Stride. And there were some, you know, there were some obstacles that you were navigating at the time. And I think that it would be interesting to talk about what was going on. A lot of times people think that the El Dorado is when you get a book contract and you're just kind of, you know, faced with a deadline and you just have to plug away at your planning and your organization. But there are other obstacles that we don't really hear so much about. Can you tell us a little bit about what was difficult about that work at the time and what you were challenged by?
Sure. Well, I actually published a book before. My first book was a coloring book called Edible Paradise that came out when coloring books were a thing. And so that one was all me, so to speak. There were no words. And so I was really able to, you know, just do whatever I wanted, so to speak. And then my publisher wanted to do a Paris-related book. And so, and then it became a New York book as well. And so I worked with two different writers on those. And it's just a different workflow, you know. I was the chef de projet, as you're the project manager, so to speak. And so it's just always difficult working intensely with other people sometimes and, you know, finding a workflow that works. And sometimes it doesn't work out either. And it's hard to navigate those relationships sometimes if it's, I think I've learned more about myself since then too, but you know, if you feel like people aren't holding the project on the same level that you are, or you feel much more invested in it, then it's kind of like, you know, group project in college where you feel like you're pulling all the weight sometimes, or you're much more invested in getting an A, so to speak. So, I mean, writing a book, it's not even just, you know, you might have 1 year to write a book and you think, oh, that's amazing. You know, I have all the time in the world, but there's a lot of back and forth, and, you have to think about it almost on a 2-3 year timeline where, okay, I need to have the passion to write this book for 1 year, and then I need the passion to sell this book, and, you know, being able to make it work for me. And oftentimes advances aren't enough to really live off of as well. So how can I manage working intensely on this new project and also maintaining all the other work that I need to do just to stay afloat? So it's a lot.
And so what do you remember from that period that you were able to get through that was difficult? What were the tools or any kind of mindset shifts that you were able to adopt that helped diminish some of the ickiness and the difficulty?
Yeah, I think that I think just realizing that creative partnerships aren't always what you think they are. You think, okay, we're this is exciting. We're both working on this project together. We should be able to come to it with a place of excitement, and, you know, but it's not always as easy as that. And, you know, I realize that it's not the first creative collaboration that didn't work out swimmingly. You know, if you look, you know, the Beatles had plenty of issues, et cetera, and they were able to work through them. But yeah, I think communication is key. And also, I mean, I feel like I've been able to move on. But yeah, I think I definitely would do things differently now as well.
There was also, I mean, you were also going through some personal stuff. I remember you had said that you and Cyril were trying to have a baby, and that you had recently had a sad miscarriage. And you began a whole chapter creatively where you started to express some of the things that you had gone through in your personal life, and specifically with the miscarriage as part of your healing process, really. What really moved you to open up that part of your life and start sharing the painful experience and emotions around having a miscarriage with other people?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of the rule of 10,000 hours, where I was already an illustrator for some time and I was able, I thought, you know, my work was good, but I think this kind of was the ultimate test for me of, you know, what do I want to share? I felt like maybe my skills were good enough now where I could actually share it in a way where it was effective, and it was kind of merging the actual technical skills of drawing and the storytelling, and it was the ultimate fuel. I feel like, you know, having a kid is a whole new breadth of work, so to speak, even if it doesn't necessarily work out the way you want it to. Mm-hmm. And so when it happened, I felt really low and isolated, and I didn't really know what to make of it. And so I had some time during the months afterwards where I felt like I just need to document this. I don't know why. I'm just going to draw. I'm going to document the funny things, the stupid things, the, you know, weird things that happened, all the little details. I think just to work through it. And I thought, well, if I can use this in some way to help someone out, then that's better. So I didn't really see any. I mean, I know now. I know of a few references of in pop culture where miscarriage has been mentioned as well, but I just feel like maybe felt at the time that I could use the grief period to try to make something that could be A, self-healing, and B, hopefully help someone else out as well.
Mm.
And so I did a first draft. I thought, oh, maybe I'll try to pitch this around and someone can publish it. But it was way too raw. It was emotional vomit. Just it was not very structured or very straightforward. And so I kind of just let it rest for a while, and then I came back to it with fresh eyes, and I regrouped a lot of the images that I made together, and I almost did like a little micro story for Instagram about how to cope during a miscarriage. And so it wasn't all the personal stuff, which really shouldn't be shared. It's too much. But then it was more about, okay, this is what it feels like to have a miscarriage, and this is how you can help someone else out. And so I just was very pragmatic about that. So I was scared to share it, of course, because, you know, it's of course a great privilege that people respond to your work. But even right after, I got so many messages from people telling me about their losses and this and that, and, you know, even the IVF struggles, and, you know, it's not just miscarriage, but it's all these other things. So it's, I mean, I appreciate people reaching out to me, but it can be a lot to to navigate sometimes too. Yes, it was very scary. I didn't want to look at my phone for a couple of hours, and then I eventually did, and, you know, we had like 100 comments, and it was all just like, I mean, it's nice people say, oh, I'm so sorry, but at the end of the day, it's kind of sometimes just like, oh, you're almost reliving through it again because you're reminded of it. And so there's, I think with trauma, sometimes it can be hard to share that kind of stuff, even if people have good intentions, you know, about being supportive. And even some people, you just don't, you don't want to tell everyone about something traumatic in your life, and now everyone knows. And so even I've reshared it sometimes, and people are like, oh, I'm so sorry about your other loss. I'm like, no, it's six. It's a repost, you know.
This is old information. But that's so, what would you do differently, or what would you now in hindsight maybe have put in place to protect yourself if you felt like it was opening up wounds that you didn't want to relive?
I don't think I would have done it differently. I just think understanding that, of course, if you open this part of yourself to the world, then people are going to want to engage, or they're going to want to share stories, which is normal because A, it's rare to see these kinds of things, and B, that's kind of what I wanted, was to help other people out. So, I mean, I think I can't read all the messages, but I think it's if you're willing to share that much about yourself, then you're going to get many kinds of responses.
And was there anything surprising to you that emerged out of that space?
I mean, I kind of know, obviously this was super personal. I kind of knew that it would have a big impact, especially since I hadn't seen anything like it before. I don't know. I mean, it kind of made me want to be a little bit more guarded about certain things, or not share too much about fertility, just because it can be something that's not triggering, but it can open up a lot of personal stuff that I didn't really feel like making public. I've also feel like I've revisited that body of work since then. I'm writing this book at the moment. And so thinking about self-healing. I've had a child since then too. So I think that opens up a whole other reinterpretation of why that had to happen or not, so that I can be where I am. Actually, I think it's because of this body of work that I did, where I think in the original sketches, I think the only moment that I was really able to identify from being pregnant the first time, and I feel like once you become pregnant, you think about all the things that, all the what ifs and all of the, you know, responsible things that you should be doing that you don't really connect with what's actually happening within your body and the implications of all of that. And so when I was pregnant the first time, I was playing guitar one day and I was singing Chelsea Morning by Joni Mitchell, and I actually recorded myself on a voice memo. And I feel like it was the only moment where I was able to feel something that wasn't filled with anxiety, or something that was about the what ifs, or about, you know, climate change or anything like that. It was just a pure moment where I was intentional and saying, okay, this is a moment that I'm going to share this beautiful song that I love. I'm visualizing the things, and I'm transmitting this to the life that's growing within my body. And so being able to revisit that, I think, you know, after I had my miscarriage, I listened back on that recording several times a day. You know, I felt like it was an emotional barometer where I could say, oh my God, I'm really not well, or like, okay, I guess today's a little bit better. And then for me, I think throughout the whole experience, this for me was the visual takeaway. So whenever I still think about it, I still get sad sometimes, but I feel like instead of going into that dark place, I can say, this is the moment. I see the visuals of the song. I see that moment where I was able to share this with this life, you know, or whatever you want to call it. And for me, that's the sweet takeaway. So I feel like I was able to paint a new picture of something that happened to me, and that's given me strength and it's helped me move on as well.
Thank you for sharing that. That's really touching.
Yeah, but you can see there are many different edits of this story too. So I think with time, I was able to extract that from the body of work, having the luxury of retrospect and say like, this is, I'm okay. I'm, you know, it's not, I'm not going to let it go away forever. I feel like I've done the work. I can pinpoint this. I'm going to take it with me. The grief, if it comes, it comes. But this is what I'm going to hold on to now.
You said this kind of self-healing process in the book that you're working on right now. Can you tell us a little bit what that's about?
Yes. So in September last year, I sold my next book, which is about watercolor and storytelling. So it's learning the techniques of watercolor and then also how to tell your own story. And a lot of it is based on, a lot of the things I mentioned about moving to Paris, finding your way as an artist, etc. And so I don't know if this is going to make it. Actually, I sent kind of a version of that first draft of the miscarriage story to my agent. She was like, oh, I don't know. Let's keep it fun. Let's keep it, you know.
She's like, sellable. Okay, yeah, let's
whoa. Try.
Yeah, let's. So the book is about using the artistic process and the storytelling process to move through parts of your personal story or difficult moments in one's personal story?
And yeah, so there are 30 days of exercises from the simplest to the most complex, but it's not super deep into self-healing. I feel like this has kind of been something that's revealed itself in the process of writing the book. And I think maybe there are a few exercises that'll be focused on this. I'm not an art therapist by any means, but I do talk about, you know, how watercolor is a way that I've been able to not only identify my world and to digest it, but also to work through grief and other complex emotions and being able to understand myself a little bit better.
That's beautiful. I'm so excited about this. What do you think that makes watercolor a medium that lends itself well to that kind of self-expression and maybe self-healing?
I mean, for me, it's just what I've been using for the last, you know, over 10 years. So it's some, you know, it's the medium that I know the best. But, you know, I mean, it sounds cliche, but, you know, water is what connects us all. It's, reminds us of the womb. I mean, it's crazy, but after I had my miscarriage, I remember I was making this pretty intense pattern for a beauty brand. And I kept crying when I was working out and I was seeing like fetuses and the watermarks I was doing. It was just like, oh my God, this is too much. But it's fluid. I think there's something, I mean, much like in the work that you do with your clients, I think there's only so much control you can have with watercolor. It's something that you can apply on a page, but at the end of the day, you don't know how it's going to end, or it's kind of a choose your own adventure kind of thing where you can control it as much as you want. But the real beauty is that you'll see, you know?
Well, also, I don't know. I mean, maybe this is too obvious, but just, I don't know. I'm thinking about like tears and the, you know, the purification of our, you know, our emotions and then just washing away some of the hurt in a way that's just very organic. And I think when I've tested my hands at watercolor, I find it very, there's something kind of intuitive about it because it is so fluid. It just kind of has a life of its own. You have to let it just do its thing. You can't
control
it very much.
I mean, you can be intentional about what you want to do, but a lot of the times it's just, you'll see.
Well, to shift the energy a little bit, I wanted to. So we both have had these really crazy stage moments, stage breakthroughs in our lives, which just so happened to happen coincidentally in tandem. So I performed Beastie Boys Fight for Your Right live in front of 200 people and was unprepared and felt amazing about it. And then I found out a day later that you had decided to go up and tackle stand-up comedy for the first time in your life. So we've had some conversations together about how these experiences have unleashed some kind of inner child healing and building confidence and overcoming some of our fears. Tell us a little bit more. What made you decide to get up and tell funny stories in front of strangers?
I had like this long-term cold for 2 months and I was just feeling really shitty. And I think it was right after the Oscars. I watched the opening. I was still sick in bed. I watched the opening monologue by Jimmy Kimmel. And there was something in my mind where it's just like, wait a minute, I can do this. I'm going to try. And so I wrote a text, and then right away, I mean, it was the same morning I was practicing it in front of the mirror, and I was like, I have to do this. There's no, I mean, just because it's scary. I know I can do it. So why shouldn't I try? And so I reluctantly sent the video to a few friends, and they're like, whoa, wow, that's actually kind of good. Like, you should try. And then a couple of weeks later, I just signed up for an open mic and I did it. And so it was scary. I felt like I was going to throw up all week. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, I mean, I can't remember anything that happened before, but I got up there and I felt completely at ease, and that, you know, I did study theater and I've always wanted to be a musical theater actress. So I felt like for me, it was doing what I do already. It was just an extension of, you know, writing jokes or doing visual jokes, and then being able to take it to another kind of platform, which is really cool. And post pandemic, I just feel like any excuse it is to go out and to get dressed up and to,
right,
to meet people and to feel like not like myself for a second is totally worth it. So I'm addicted now.
Wow. It's so cool. It is so cool. So, I mean, yeah. And we shared this comment about like wanting to feel new feelings, wanting to feel alive in a way and kind of overcome certain fears that you know you can overcome. So like being able to distinguish what's a really terrifying fear, like a paralyzing fear, and what's just a fear that maybe is a residual fear from maybe not wanting to make a fool of yourself, or you're not going to be perfect. So what do you think you've grown in yourself since you've started doing this? Like, what's happened?
I don't know. I mean, already it's kind of cool to find a whole new passion. And I feel like I've just been working up to this. I just feel like it's all of these things that happened in the past couple of years. Maybe it's a pandemic, having a kid, just wanting to. I don't even think about what stand-up can do for writing. I mean, I've always loved writing. I'm obviously writing a book, but I just feel like I'm on a whole new trajectory where I just feel like the sky's the limit at this point. So, I mean, it's amazing being able to make people laugh is a gift, but still just being able to do that and feeling like I just scratched the surface. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's cool being a woman too, where you feel like I'm just going to continue evolving and growing and, you know, changing my practice to whatever it becomes. But it's really exciting doing something like this. And it can, obviously, you know, it's almost like between styling and illustration. I felt limited in styling. And of course, illustration and writing is great, but this is kind of the whole next step of, you know, being the performer and taking it to another level. So,
well, also the costume. I mean, you were very like decked out and like gorgeous and wearing lots of bling and your hair up in a cool do. So is there like also, kind of like a part of your identity that you're able to create a stage for by doing this?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, having a background in theater, it makes sense. I feel like I haven't tapped into this part of myself for 20 years when I realized I didn't like auditioning for things, but it's cool being able to generate your own thing too and say like, okay, I have 4 minutes. I'm going to go, I'm going to do my thing. I know all about everything I've learned about marketing yourself, about, you know, writing something that's tight, about, I feel like it's just an accumulation of all of my life experience and now having the confidence, or, you know, I'm not entirely confident, but, you know, the confidence that comes with age and saying, okay, I can do this. You better watch out. I feel like, yeah, it's another kind of manifestation thing where I don't know. I mean, I don't really have any ambitions at the moment for this, but I feel like it's going to open up something either in me or in my work, or, you know, who knows? Mm. I don't know if I answered your question, but
yeah. Well, I mean, it's we've talked also about like this idea of healing certain parts of our inner child, and so it's compelling, this idea of maybe at a certain age in our lives being able to say like, I don't need all of the confidence, I just need enough confidence. And
yeah, yeah.
You're working enough towards doing things that you want to do. And maybe it's not going to be perfect, but it's just a matter about just kind of going out there and having fun.
Yeah, I mean, even since I was a kid, I always felt like a par, like always on the side, or like I was never what people wanted me to be, or, you know, I didn't feel like I was shy, but everyone told me I was shy. And so I think being able to just get up there and do something crazy like that, especially in France where people never dared to do something crazy like stand up, I think just kind of knowing like, okay, I know I'm an artist. I know I'm emotional. I know I'm sensitive. I'm all of these things, but it doesn't mean I can't do what I want to do. It doesn't mean that I can't see things. You know, I think, you know, an artist is a collector of references, of stories. And I think, now knowing that about myself, like, I'm going to cry because I moved. Okay. It's not a bad thing. I'm not going to have to apologize because it makes you uncomfortable. You know, I'm moved by color. I'm moved by, you know, just talking or listening to somebody's story. I think these are all things that make me who I am. And so I think when you neglect that for long enough, or you try to, which doesn't always happen either, I think it just being able to say and being able to make mistakes and say, yes, I'm not perfect. Yes, I'm emotional. It doesn't mean I'm out of control. I'm very responsible. I do everything I need to do. You know, I'm not, you know, this artist type who's just flapping in the wind. Like I'm able to take care of myself and my family. And I think, you know, from that vulnerability, I'm able to speak of truth. I'm able to see the world around me with different eyes too. So I think just kind of coming into my own in that way is very powerful. And just looping back to, you know, growing up in the inner city and always feeling out of place, no matter where I am. I mean, being a kid and hanging out with, you know, teenagers in the 90s and listening to house music on the radio in the back of the car with my dad. And I don't know, going to basketball camp where I was the only white girl, or, you know, going to liberal arts school where everyone was super rich and driving Volvos. And I was just this inner city kid on a scholarship, and then moving to France where, of course, you know, what am I going to do about it? But just kind of knowing that, like, I can get on no matter where I am. You know, I can hold my own. I can hang out with pretentious Parisian types and make them laugh. I mean, there's no reason why I don't belong here, you know?
Wow. Thank you. That was amazing. That was amazing. The tying it all together. There was something about like this kind of like feeling confident in that those in-between spaces, and where you're not entirely, you don't entirely feel like you belong, or maybe you perceive the world in a way that's more raw or messy than other people, and being able to channel that into lots of different forms of expression and creativity, with this new frontier being comedy.
Yeah. Or even just identifying myself as a child and saying, like, this is why you're like this. It's not because you're weird or you're not adjusted to life. It's, you know, you're an artist. It's just what it is. So I feel like I want to write a children's book for parents who have kids who are just a little bit off or a little bit, you know, too deeply feeling, so to speak, not to quote Dr. Becky, but, you know, but, you know, just to say, like, there's nothing wrong with you. Like, you're able to do so much, but you just don't know how to channel the colors and channel the emotions and channel this. I mean, it's not easy either. I don't want to give anyone the impression that I'm just like, but, you know, I'm still coping with how to be able to have this power to do this work, but I don't know. It's kind of a lifelong process, I think.
Well, thank you so much for doing what you do, Jessie.
Thank you. Thank you for being a wonderful friend and an inspiration. Aww. I mean, I've seen you. We had a coffee about it, and you talked about, oh, I don't know what I want to do with my life, but there's something with circles and circles and circles and circles.
We keep looping around those circles, and here we are. It's happening now. The circles are coming finally.
No, I'm thankful that I know you. I feel like you've been a big part of my life and in important moments. So I appreciate you.
Oh, thank you, sweetie. Well, I'm happy to be to be walking the walk with you, yes. And to be showing up at your Friday night gigs now.
Yeah. Please come.
Very excited. So
yes. And for all the artists out there, it's not a straight path, but it's always, you know, you got to accept the fact that you're an artist and try to make it work, and it'll hopefully, if it's meant to be, you'll find a way.
All right. With that said, thank you so much, Jessie.
And thank you.
We'll be linking to all of your wonderful work in the show notes.
Thank you.
I am so appreciative of having your time and your attention and would love to hear anything you have to say, any feedback, any questions, any requests. You can leave me a voice message if you go to speakpipe.com/onbecoming. That's speakpipe, speakpipe.com/onbecoming. I promise to get back to you. If this podcast has touched you, inspired you, transformed you in any way, it would mean the world to me if you would leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcast listening platform.